Okay. Hello, everybody. Welcome to this. I think it's our first Zoom public meeting of Newcastle Stop the War. Yeah, Northeast. Its title is NATO War and the Special Relationship, which is all very scary. We've got some announcements about things that are coming up from Stop the War, but I think I'll put them in at the end, Alex, if that's okay.
Great.
As you probably know, NATO was set up at the end of the War of 1949, really at the start of the Cold War, ostensibly as a mutual defence pact against Russia, basically, the threat of Soviet invasion. But reality is that we've had military uniting of Western countries under US control, and now, more recently, Eastern expansion. And most frighteningly to me, that NATO is ensuring US dominance over Europe. But anyway, our first speaker is Alex Snowden, who's a long-standing campaigner with Newcastle Stop the War, a teacher and an activist in the National Education Unit. So over to you, Alex, for about 10 minutes. Yeah.
Great, yeah, I'll just talk for about 10 minutes, Pam, and everyone else. And just the sort of three key things I want to comment on, and then Roger's gonna talk for about 10 minutes. And then we've got time for discussion. So any questions that people have or any comments of your own, any contributions about the issues that we're raising, it'd be great to hear in the discussion. We have a monthly meeting in Newcastle Stop the War, but we decided, having had a series of kind of organising or committee-based meetings in Newcastle Stop the War, it'd be better to have a topic that we discuss, you know, really discuss the big issues in terms of the world that we live in and some of the conflicts that are going on and that are particularly relevant to Stop the War. And of course, that is the basis for our campaigning and for any organising that we do, and the pressure that we build and the movement that we build, is having an understanding of the latest phase, really, of what is going on globally. So making sense of what's happening in the world provides us with that basis for our campaigning efforts. And one bit of the title, NATO, I'm not really going to address directly, because I believe Roger's going to talk a bit more directly about NATO. But the other two parts of it, war and the special relationship, I would like to comment on. And the first thing is just to say a little bit about the legacy of US and US-led intervention, which, of course, successive British governments have consistently backed and been part of since 2001. And the beginning of the so-called War on Terror, and look at the impact of that on a number of countries. Secondly, a little bit about what's going on now, where I think we're at with the Trump administration, with Trump in the White House, with Johnson in Downing Street, some of the particular threats and challenges that we face at the moment, and try and get that kind of big picture that frames the campaigning that we're involved in now. And just a little bit finally about where our own government fits in and the situation in British politics, but mainly focusing on the impact of US and US-led military intervention. And there are four countries in particular where there's been a huge impact from Western military intervention since 2001: Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Libya. And of course, intervention of one sort or another has not been limited to those countries, but they are the particular countries that it makes sense to talk about. In Afghanistan, in the autumn of 2001, we saw an invasion where, at the time, I remember, you know, the pictures and the scenes on TV of the liberation, as they called it, of Kabul, and the euphoria that was in the Western media and from politicians and so on about how this war had now been won, it was over, mission accomplished, and everything was going to be fine. Nearly 20 years later, there is still military involvement, there's still troops on the ground, there has been absolute devastation, an enormous number of people killed or wounded in Afghanistan, but also many, many years of occupation and internal conflict in Afghanistan as a result of that intervention. The destruction, really, of any sort of functioning state apparatus, the destruction of a lot of basic infrastructure that people need to live their lives. And also, and this is going to be a common pattern with a number of different countries, the strengthening and the revival of the very forces of sort of jihadism and terrorism and so on that were supposedly being combated and were supposedly being defeated by US and Western intervention. So the revival of the strength of the Taliban, for example, and there is a process at the moment. There are peace talks going on this week, in fact, a process that involves the release of thousands of Taliban prisoners, where negotiations are going on between the US and the Taliban. And this is nearly 20 years after we were told that they had been destroyed. Iraq, at least as horrific as the situation in Afghanistan. I don't know if people have watched the series that has been on, it's currently on the BBC. It's available on BBC iPlayer, a very hard-hitting, powerful, five-part documentary on Iraq, which gets across the different perspectives, the different experiences of all sorts of people affected by it. And I think particularly strong within that is the voices of the Iraqi people themselves, including people who started out as pro-war. There's one guy in that who's very eloquent, who talked about how he wanted to get rid of Saddam and he wanted to get rid of that government, and he welcomed the invasion in 2003, but then very much turned against it, as he saw, and as lots of Iraqis saw, the reality of that war. It has been utterly devastating. Hundreds of thousands of people are estimated to have been killed. Pretty much everyone in Iraq knows someone, has someone in their family or extended family who was killed. Again, the collapse of basic infrastructure. Again, the fueling of sectarian tensions and divisions and conflicts, and fueling not just terrorism, but the absolutely horrific rise of the Islamic State, which leads on to a third country that has been devastated by military intervention, and that's Syria. And in Syria, a lot of it was to do with the dynamics of civil war in Syria from about 2011, 2012 onwards. But the role of the West, and in particular the US, has made things worse through the arming of so-called rebels on one side of the civil war, through bombing campaigns repeatedly in Syria, and also, of course, the horrendous growth of ISIS in Syria, as well as in Iraq, has very much been fueled by the fallout from the war on terror and from the failures of the war on terror. In particular, the invasion and the occupation of Iraq had a massive effect on fueling the rise of that jihadism in Syria. And finally, Libya, which is often overlooked and forgotten about, but in 2011 there was, for a couple of months, a sustained and terrible NATO bombing campaign. It was under the banner of NATO on Libya, which is estimated to have killed probably 30,000 people. But the impact of that was it almost destroyed any sort of functioning government. You ended up with sort of rival factions, each claiming to represent the people, each sort of governing different areas. A huge amount of ongoing conflict within Libya as a result of that, the fallout from it. And again, fueling terrorism. And, you know, to sum up the impact on those different countries, as well as high levels of death, people being wounded, destruction, three key things stand out, really. One is the level of destabilization. These are countries that generally had fairly awful and undemocratic regimes previously, and often abusing human rights and so on. But things have got a lot worse, and things that had been taken for granted have collapsed, and there's been this massive destabilization. A second effect is the rise of terrorism, very much fueled by Western military intervention. And of course, another thing is something that's in the news at the minute, which is a huge increase in the refugee population. People turned into refugees, fleeing their homes because of the wars and because of the violence in those countries, which is never talked about in the media coverage we've had in the last week or two of refugees desperately trying to get into this country, is that it's because we bombed them there that they are coming here. And of course, the vast majority of those refugees have not come anywhere near Europe, never mind Britain specifically. Most of them have found refuge in neighbouring countries. Only a small minority have ended up in Europe. So that's really the legacy of US intervention and the interventions by its allies over the last 20 years. In terms of the current context, I'll just briefly say I think where we are now is very much shaped by the fallout from the failures of the war on terror, the destruction, the devastation, and the instability and the chaos that that has brought. Also, of course, the US feels increasingly threatened by two countries, really, that it perceives as rivals, China and Russia. I think China is the far more important one of those two. Economically, it is a much stronger and more powerful rival to the US. And a lot of the American foreign policy now is shaped by the perceived geopolitical threat from China. And what we're mainly seeing for now is either sort of economic warfare, you know, the sort of sanctions and trade restrictions and so on, and things like the news last week around TikTok. Trump was desperate for an American-based corporation to take over this Chinese company, and we get, you know, these sorts of conflicts. This kind of conflict between the US and China is often finding its expression in those sorts of economic ways, or through the role of proxy powers. So one other aspect, I think one of the fault line at the moment is what's happening in Yemen. And it's not the US intervening directly, it's a regional power that is a very, very close ally of the US, which is Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia really provides one of the pillars of support for US foreign policy in the Middle East. And the role of those sorts of regional powers, sometimes Turkey, sometimes Israel, sometimes Egypt, has become very important as well in the absence a lot of the time of direct US military intervention. I mentioned Saudi and Yemen. I think that is a key fault line. Another one is Israel. Trump has ardently supported everything that Netanyahu and his government in Israel has done, provocatively moving the US embassy to Jerusalem, which was a massive insult to the Palestinians, and ruling out any chances of a Palestinian state, the horrendous funding cuts to UNRWA that Palestinian refugees rely on, and so on. So there are a number of different fault lines, and I haven't mentioned, of course, Iran, which is very important. At the start of this year, we had the assassination of a senior Iranian military commander. And although things have died down for now, this is something that could well escalate again with US threats towards Iran. So those different fault lines are at work there, and they are shaped by, as I say, the fallout from the failures of 20 years of military intervention, by the US weaknesses in many ways, and the sense of being threatened by its rivals, and also, of course, by Trump. The fact that Trump is such a, it's difficult to know how to describe him, isn't it, but kind of has a certain unhinged quality, shall we say. And there's no doubt that in some ways he accentuates those problems. However, I don't think it would be sensible to assume that if he is thrown out in November, as he probably will be, and Joe Biden becomes president, I think it would be wrong to assume that everything is going to become fine again. If we recall the 8 years of Obama's administration, we saw a massive rise in drone warfare. We saw huge reluctance to actually withdraw troops from places where he promised to withdraw troops from, and so on. In many ways, it was a big disappointment. The final thing, just to note, before Roger takes over, is just, I think this is something to come back to in the discussion, really. I'm not going to say much about this. But where Britain fits in, Britain is always supportive, and whether it's been new Labour governments with Blair and Brown or Tory governments for the last 10 years, consistently supportive of Washington foreign policy. Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of Labour represented, in some ways, at least a partial break from that, an alternative to that. Corbyn's own politics, very much the politics of the anti-war movement. And that found some reflection for a few years in Labour policy. I think what we are now seeing is a push back to the old consensus, the old Atlanticist pro-Washington consensus, where we have both of the big political parties in this country loyally supporting pretty much anything that an American president does. Whether it's membership of NATO, support for nuclear weapons with Trident replacement, support for wars and military intervention, support for Israeli apartheid. On all of these fronts, we tend to see very loyal and implacable support from the British government for Washington. Our job as a movement has always been to build the maximum pressure to break that support, to break the allegiance, the tight special relationship between the British government and the American. And that, I think that continues to be our big challenge, and we should be thinking about where we can make progress for that. And I think, you know, hopefully the fault lines that I've outlined, key areas that I've talked about, give some sense of where we need to be exerting pressure on our own government, as well as opposing Trump and the US. So I'll leave it there, Pam.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Thank you, Alex. That's a very...
I got to go.
Okay, Liz.
Sorry, Liz.
Thank you, Alex. A very comprehensive summary of the last 20 years of the frightening, devastating results of all this military intervention. And then lastly, what can we do about it? What is the war's aims in this, you know, what is their role?